Over the course of the last few months, I have on and off been speaking on Sri Vishnu Sahasranama, which literally means the thousand names of Vishnu, going through name by name. And today I'm on the 47th. There's a long way to go. But we have unlimited time. Not in this world, in this life, but time is eternal. Time is meant for glorifying Krishna. So he is glorified by these names. And we can understand the nature of reality, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, by his names. Not simply by an intellectual method, by his mercy, we can understand who he is to the extent that we can with our very little intelligence. So this name that I wish to speak on now is, among all the names of Vishnu, this one is a very important name because it, in the name itself, it defines the relationship between him and us. The name is Hrishikesha, a well-known name. Not as well-known as Krishna, Hari, these are the best known names, Govinda, Gopala. Hrishikesha is not so well-known, but it's very important. It's in Bhagavad Gita, the name that is mentioned of Krishna is the most mentioned name is Krishna, and the name or title Bhagavan, these two are most mentioned, and next is Hrishikesha. Other names are there also, Govinda, Madhusudana, Madhava, but Keshava, but Hari. But this name, Hrishikesha, is the third most used name in Bhagavad Gita. It literally means the master of the senses. Hrishika means senses, and Isha means controller of the senses. So this is generally, Srila Prabhupada always explains this to mean, he who controls all the senses of all living beings have senses. There's living being means a sentient being. That is the difference between all of us, and all of us here meaning all sentient beings, which includes ants and snakes and birds, we can hear the birds. Plants, they're all sentient beings and insentient. Noise is there. But it's the microphone is not aware that it's making a noise. It's insentient. So Krishna is the master or the controller of all the senses. Now, one reason this name is very important is that it establishes that he is sentient. The absolute reality is not insentient, is not not impersonal. Who is the master of the senses must himself be sentient, must have senses. So there is a common misconception about the nature of ultimate spiritual reality, that ultimate spiritual reality is not a person. It is an indefinable, universal, omnipresent, and then you can give so many adjectives, but you can't give a noun. Because thing, it's not a thing, essence, it's the idea that's indefinable. But here, on the authority of Bhishma Dev, who is the speaker of Vishnu Sahasranama, who is the great authority on spiritual knowledge, we find this name is given, Hrishikesh, the Lord of the senses, which means that he is not insentient. The Lord of the senses, that means he's the Lord of his own senses and of all other senses also. So the problem comes for people of less intelligence who think that they understand spiritual reality, but their understanding is limited because they think that the unlimited cannot have senses, because as soon as you have a senses, you're a person. And the idea that a person, well, a person is different to other people, so that means he's limited. He's distinguishable from others. And also that the idea that a person is in one place, but so that means he's not everywhere. But this conception is due to trying to understand the supreme reality through our own limited intelligence and conceptions. Ah, you said Bhagavan for supreme reality. Mm-hmm. There we go. Problems with language. We were just talking about that. Bhagavan means the supreme person. And the supreme person is Bhagavan. But we're trying to establish that here philosophically. So the general term is Brahma, which the general term in Sanskrit term is, which is translated back into English and is Brahma. But that Brahma is Bhagavan, that you know, but not everyone knows. So I'm saying supreme reality here. That's the Tamil word. German word there must be with all these big philosophers in Germany. What's the word? Supreme reality. Yeah, it's a construct put together. There's no small simple term like Brahma. As in, it seems that from that complex word, it seems that the concept came later in the development of the language, right? It was introduced later. Whereas in Sanskrit and Brahma, it's there from the beginning. Absolute truth, it's often said in English. So the supreme is the supreme, supreme reality is the supreme person. With senses, that means he touches, tastes, feels, smells, hears, thinks, feels, likes, dislikes, the Supreme Person, Vishnu, Hrishikesh, the controller of the senses. In Vedic culture, those who are trying to understand Brahma, they should control their senses. This is the first step in self-realization, is to control the senses. And actually that's a basic condition of civilized life. Even if one is not particularly thinking about spiritual realization, sense control is required. For instance, if you see in a shop some nice food, you may desire to eat it. But the training is there that if you have to go in and pay the money and you don't just go in and eat it, right? You may desire some property of someone, but you're trained that not to just take it. The reason for that, well, there morality is taught in human society. There's also the fear of punishment, which is there. So sense control is forced by the laws of the state or by social custom, so that people can live in a state which is different to that of wild animals. So sense control, I mean, even among animals, they work, some animals work cooperatively. So sense control is a condition of cooperative existence, but in spiritual advancement, sense control means to, the senses are controlled so that sensual desires, which are the obstacle in spiritual realization, that they are overcome. The idea, I want this, I want that. And then from the desire comes the endeavor to get it. And in this way, the consciousness is absorbed in mundane activities. But if one sees that the endeavor to material desires and the endeavor to fulfill them, this is what entangles us in material life, then one should try to overcome material desires. And that is done by trying to control the senses. So yogis, they do not eat more than is required, nor do they eat less than required, nor do they use any of the senses any more than is required for simple maintenance of the body, not to indulge the senses. So someone who has controlled their senses, they are understood to be partaking in the nature of God, who is not a Hrishikesh. The Supreme Person is not a victim of petty desires, as everyone in this material world is. And the whole so-called modern civilization, which is advertised as being the ultimate human civilization developed after so many centuries, is just the basic aim is simply to fulfill the desires in an animalistic way, sophisticated methods for being an animal, for fulfilling all the desires as much as possible. And it's passed off as highly advanced civilization, but it's just animalism. Whereas in Vedic culture or spiritual culture, someone is considered to be advanced not by how much expert they are at accumulating objects for sense enjoyment, but by their detachment. They have no need for that. Who is the advanced person? Not someone who lives in a big house with lots of money, but someone who is content to live with as little as possible. That person is advanced. He's not a victim of his desires. So such a person is understood to partake in the nature of God, who is not a victim of his desires. But to attain that state is also only possible by the grace of Hrishikesh, the controller of the senses. Because we are very small and we are very weak. And there are many instances in history of people who are endeavoring yogis, endeavoring to control their senses, who are just in a second thrown back into the ocean of material desires by not taking shelter of Krishna, who can help them. We are so weak that we cannot control our desires without help from Krishna. So Hrishikesh means the controller of the senses. He also means that the life that the senses, the perception, That also comes from Krishna. We are living beings. What is the symptom of our being living? Is that we have perception, consciousness, seeing, touching, feeling, smelling, all this. Without that, how alive are you? If you're deaf, blind, dumb, you can't hear, you can't taste, are you alive? In one sense, you could be. Just like people are in a coma or on a life support system, and the question of euthanasia comes. I mean, what's the point of keeping such a person alive if they have no sensual interaction or no thoughts? They're bodily alive, but the consciousness is dead. The consciousness is inactive. So, the function of the senses, that comes from Krishna. He is the life of our life. Our senses can't function without His grace. Everything is dependent on His grace. Hrishikanam isha hrishikeshaha. The Lord of the senses is Hrishikesh. Now, that He's the master of the senses doesn't mean that He controls us like someone with a computer controls a robot. He gives us limited independence to exercise our sensual functions. Now, there are two basic ways in which the sensual functions can be exercised, depending on the consciousness of the individual. One is in the consciousness of wanting to enjoy the senses for oneself, and that consciousness keeps us in the material world. And the other is to offer the action of our senses into His service, to that our senses should function to please His senses. The idea that I shall enjoy this material world gives rise to, well, it's from this consciousness. Ishvaroham aham bhogi siddhoham balavan suki. I am the controller. I am the enjoyer. I am perfect, powerful, and happy. And we think like, I am in control here. And then we think that my senses, that everything that we see or touch or hear or smell or feel or hear, we think this is all meant for me. But when we realize that everything is meant for Krishna, and we offer it to Him. The one flower you can take and enjoy smelling it. Or you can take and offer it to Krishna. Krishna, He should enjoy smelling it. Then we shall take and we shall smell. And we shall be happy thinking how nicely Krishna has enjoyed. So in both cases, the senses are employed, but in one case, one is thinking, everything is for my pleasure. In another case, we're thinking this is for Krishna's pleasure, and we become happy thinking how Krishna has enjoyed. So one kind of pleasure, you can say smelling the flower is the same thing, but in one case, the senses, the consciousness is of putting my own pleasure at the center, and the other is bhakti, that means Krishna's pleasure. How Krishna shall be happy. Everything is offered for His pleasure. And we actually become happy by doing that because we are dependent on Him. And our natural happy position is to be His servant. So Krishna gives us limited independence so that we can exercise our sensual functions either in His service or to try to enjoy separately from Him. But that doesn't work. It doesn't happen. We're not happy. No one is happy trying to enjoy themselves. It's the great illusion of this material world that we shall be happy by touching, smelling, tasting, feeling, hearing, without any relationship to Krishna. It's a great illusion, and no one's happy. Yehi sangsparshaja bhoga dukha yonya evate adyantavanta kontaya na teshu ramate buddha. One verse from Bhagavad Gita. If people could understand, they could actually achieve happiness. And without understanding that, that everything they do, everything that every living being does at every moment is only meant for their pleasure. But they don't get it because they don't know the secret. The secret is, as Krishna says here, that all kinds of sensual enjoyment, if we're thinking, let me enjoy, then all the way through, beginning, middle, and end, it's all simply gives rise to distress. Therefore, an intelligent person does not try to enjoy the senses independently from Krishna. Little formula, little thing to understand, but people are so addicted to sense pleasure that they remain unintelligent. In this grossly materialistic society, a country like Switzerland, which is a very small country in size and population, it's internationally known. It's better known than Chennai, which is a city in India, which has a population not much more than the whole of Switzerland to put together. But Switzerland is better known. What's the reason for that? Well, the main reason is, I guess, it's considered a prestigious country. Money. Lots of money in Switzerland. It's not famous so much for the watches or the cheese or the mountains. What else? Tennis player? Swiss, Federer, is that how you pronounce it? Yes. See, even I know, I have no interest. I don't even know the rules of tennis. But I've heard his name because I don't read the sports pages. But, huh? Federer, is it pronounced? What else is Switzerland famous for? Skiing, yeah. Well, it's the Red Cross. Well, I must admit, I didn't know it came from Switzerland. I guess I'm only quarter educated, or less. So, Switzerland is highly prestigious due to money. Money, 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 money. Lots. If you got more money than you know what to do with, send it to Switzerland. Let them lock it up for you. Stupid, isn't it? They work so hard to exploit others and kill people and everything, and they get so much money, and then you send it all to Switzerland. And Swiss people are sitting on top of it. Intelligent people. But, unfortunately, for all the prestige that comes with it, doesn't get happiness. You can't buy happiness. You can't walk into a shop and give me, you know, 2,000 francs worth of happiness. They might say, well, that's a lot of alcohol for one person at one time. But alcohol doesn't bring happiness. Nor does gold. You can decorate your whole body with gold. It's a very dangerous thing to do. But, or you can have the happiness of the satisfaction of thinking, I've got so many bars of gold locked up somewhere. But it doesn't bring happiness. So the secret to happiness is to serve Krishna, who's always happy. It's one of the features of Krishna. He's always happy. Doesn't even wear any shoes on his feet. I mean, that would be considered pretty low class in Switzerland. When he goes out to take out the cows, he doesn't even wear any shoes, but he's happy. So, by serving him, we become happy. This you know, just like crucial point. Senses, that word is there. Wait a minute, I'm jumping a bit. Yeah, this is actually the definition or one of the ways in which bhakti is defined. The term bhakti is vaguely defined as translated into English as devotion. But more specifically, Srila Prabhupada always generally translated as devotional service, following the definition, sarvopadhi vinirmuktam tatparatvena nirmalam hrishikena hrishikesha sevanam bhakti ruchate. Bhakti ruchate means bhakti is described as, that when one is free from mundane designations, such as thinking, I am Swiss, or I am male in a mundane sense, or I am female in a mundane sense, or I am 32 years old, I am a student, these are all mundane designations. When one is free from that, and one is absorbed in transcendental consciousness, free from all mundane contamination, such as lust, greed, anger, envy, illusion, pride, and so on. And one's senses are engaged in the service of Hrishikesha. That is called bhakti. So bhakti is, this name is very important because it defines, the name Hrishikesha is essential to understand who we are. We are in relation to Him. We are meant for serving Him, which means to engage the senses. Now, in English, the word sense, this is the translation of the Sanskrit word indriya. But the translation of the word indriya to sense, it's half a translation. Because the term indriya in Sanskritum covers the senses of touching, tasting, smelling, feeling, hearing, and in Sanskrit, the sense organs which go with this, the eyes, the tongue, the nose, the ears, the skin, and in Sanskrit there's one other sense which is considered the mind, which is the center of all the senses. So that's considered, and sometimes it's spoken about the six senses. But then there are a whole other set of senses. They're also called indriya, which is not exactly a sense in the English understanding. So these senses of touching, tasting, smelling, feeling, and hearing, it's all processed in the mind, right? So these are called gyan indriya. Gyana means knowledge. And knowledge in this context means perception, just like seeing. I can see out of the window there's some kind of building. Which, I don't know what kind of, what is that thing there? I don't even know what it is. What is that monstrosity, horrible looking thing there? What is it? Is that a building? There's no windows. It's a factory. It's a factory, okay. So, that just goes to show how the senses, they just by seeing, it's called gyanendriya, but it's gyan, knowledge, in a very raw state. Unless you're informed, you say, I can look at that for half an hour and I wouldn't work out it's a factory. Someone had to tell me. So it just means knowledge in the raw, in the most basic sense is acquired by the senses, by sense perception. But then there are also the karmendriyas, or what is translated as the working senses. The karma means work. So sense here It's translated, but it's not really sense in this way that in the sense of the English word sense. We say the sense of the English word sense. The word sense is used in two different ways. So the karmendriyas means the legs for walking, the hands for lifting and moving. Then the tongue is both a gyanendriya because you get taste, you experience by taste, but it has another function, which I am now performing, of speaking. So it does the work. And there's also the genital, which has the function of, it combines the function of the sexual act and excreting liquids, and the rectum, which excretes solids. So these are the working senses. So all of them are to be engaged in the service of Krishna. And the standard example, which Srila Prabhupada gives three times in his commentary on Bhagavad Gita as it is of Maharaj Ambarish, who first of all put his mind, the mind is the center of all of the senses, because the mind experiences, and the mind also says, okay, legs, go there. Oh, it doesn't exactly work. It works quicker, even without our thinking about it. We think, oh, I want to go there. Then we just go. The mind tell the legs, go there. Catch this. Like this. So, the mind is the center. So, Savai Mana Krishna Padaravindayoho. Ambarish Maharaj, first of all, placed his mind at the lotus feet of Krishna. So, he used his seeing for seeing the form, Mukunda Lingala Darshane Dusho. His eyes for seeing the form of the deity of Krishna, his ear for hearing the glorification of Krishna, his nose for smelling such smells as that of the tulasi leaf offered at the lotus feet of Krishna. And then, knowledge acquiring senses and the working senses, he used his feet to go to the temple of Krishna. He would use his arms for embracing the devotees and cleaning the temple of Krishna. So in this way, all his senses were engaged with the mind at the center. The mind with the decision that all that I touch, taste, smell, feel and hear should be in relation to Krishna. All that I do should be in relation to Krishna. So one set of senses is like receiving information. The other is acting. One is taking impulses in, and another is acting, interacting with the outside world. So all these senses are meant to be used in the service of Krishna. So that all begins with desire. How we desire to use our senses. Now, this controlling the senses, I spoke how yogis, there are many instances of yogis who fall down. Even Vishwamitra, the famous example is given, after meditating with great austerity for some thousands of years, which we can't imagine, we can't even meditate peacefully for a few seconds. We can't control the mind even for a few seconds. But by sense control and breath control, he was able to meditate for thousands of years. And people may not believe that, but, well, they may or may not, but doesn't matter to us here. So by controlling the breath, withdrawing the senses so that one doesn't use the senses in interacting with the outside world, becoming absorbed in internal consciousness, Vishwamitra was able to control his senses. But then what happened was the famous story how the Apsara, or the heavenly beautiful girl, came, and by the sound of her ankle bells, now in the modern world, they have all different kinds of fashions, but the women don't have ankle bells. But that was traditional, to have ankle bells. So tinkle, ding, 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 ding. And then he immediately thought of sensual enjoyment, and he lost his yoga practice. His just lost it in a moment after thousands of years. So it seems like almost impossible to control the senses, but this process is given, that the senses can be properly controlled by engaging them in the service of Krishna. Instead of just trying to withdraw the senses, don't enjoy nice food, don't enjoy looking at different things. We may control the senses, but it's in a very unnatural way, because we are sentient beings, which means that we have senses, and it's in the most natural thing that we want to engage, that the senses should be active. So by, instead of withdrawing, just simply withdrawing, it's sort of like holding your breath, but engage the senses, see the beautiful form of Krishna. Then we will not be attracted to seeing the beautiful things of this world. Taste the prasad offered to Krishna. Then we won't be, Swiss chocolate. That's one other thing, famous, right? Then we won't be attracted to Swiss chocolate. It's not good for the Swiss economy to preach all these things. Maybe they'll close the movement down. We're anti-national. You see? Take prasad offered to Krishna. Hear about Krishna. If we have a taste for hearing about Krishna, then we won't be interested in hearing about Roger Federer or whoever else is famous in this country. So I must admit, I'm not interested in hearing about him. I'm not saying I'm very advanced in Krishna consciousness, but his ability to hit a ball with a tennis racket, I don't find it very impressive. When you hear about Krishna, who's a lot more impressive. Now, even if he's the best in the world, is he still the best in the world?
No.
He's getting old now, is it?
Slowly
getting old. Well, it happens even to him. But it doesn't happen to Krishna. That's why it's good to hear about Krishna. Krishna doesn't get old. And he doesn't waste his time playing tennis either. So if we hear about Krishna, then we don't become attracted to hearing about things which are of no actual benefit to us or anyone else. And if you think about it, there is no real benefit to anyone in Roger Federer or anyone else hitting a tennis ball again and again. It doesn't really benefit anyone in any way. Right? I mean, materially, if someone who produces some Swiss cheese is doing something more useful for human society, you may say, well, it's entertainment, but that just entangles you in birth and death. Whereas hearing about Krishna, you may say, well, what are you doing sitting here just talking some philosophy? How does that help anyone? Well, that helps you get out of birth and death. So that's actually helpful. So to engage the senses in Krishna's service. Engage, this is the secret. So therefore, the secret of spiritual success is to engage the senses in Krishna's service. So the senses are completely satisfied in a manner that is wholly natural and beneficial for the sentient living being, and by doing so then automatically becomes freed from the mundane sensual attractions which cause us to take birth again and again in this material world and suffer again and again and again. So, another meaning of Hrishikesh. There's a word in Sanskrit, Harsha. Do you have that in Tamil? Probably not. It means it's one of the many words for pleasure, happiness. We were just talking about that, right? How different languages have different words. They have many words for something they consider very important. So in Sanskrit, there are many words for happiness. So Harsha means delight. And the name Hrishikesh, another meaning of that, is one who radiates happiness. Like the sun radiates light and heat. So Krishna radiates happiness. Just like we had that experience that those who come into the presence of Srila Prabhupada, then whatever problems they thought they had, just they don't exist anymore. And just happy. Because he is reflecting the happiness of Krishna. So Krishna is all happy and he simply radiates happiness. Anyone who's in relation with Krishna must be happy. There's no question of being Krishna conscious and being unhappy. Actually, in a higher sense, there is, but it's just like in the material world, there is happiness. We don't say there is not happiness, but it's like multiplying something by zero. When, however big it is, it all comes out as zero. So in this material world, there is happiness, but it's all multiplied by unhappiness. So everything works out as unhappiness. Whereas in the spiritual world, there is also, so there's happiness and unhappiness, but it's all multiplied by the spiritual happiness factor, who is Krishna, and therefore even the apparent distress in the spiritual world is all bliss. It's a little difficult to understand if you're in mundane consciousness. So Krishna simply radiates bliss. And anyone who comes in contact with Krishna, they must be happy. You see, you're all smiling and happy just by hearing that. Because it's a fact. And ding! Ah, that's it. That which I've been looking for millions of lifetimes. It's Krishna. That's all. That's the secret. Be happy. So many people say, be happy, but they don't know. Be happy, Krishna. That's all. Krishna is all happy. So Krishna is radiating bliss. Harsha. Actually, harsh in English means something quite opposite, doesn't it? Something nasty and cruel, but harsha in Sanskrit is bliss. They got the language wrong there a bit. So here's an example given from the Mahabharata, that just as the sun and the moon through their kesha, or their rays, the hairs are called kesh. They appear, they like kind of radiate out from the head. So the sun rays, they're kesha. So they radiate. By their radiation, they uphold the world and they cause it to awaken and to sleep. The sun causes the world to awaken and the moon to cause it to sleep. So by the appearance of the sun and the moon, the living beings of this world, they feel happiness. So, there's another meaning of Hrishikesh. Because Krishna is the behind all these functions, he is called Hrishikesh. Prabhasmi Shashi Suryo Ho. I am the Prabha, I am the radiation of the sun and the moon, Krishna says. Tapami aham, I give heat. Somo bhutva rasatmakaha. He is the he becomes the rasa, which of the moon. And so many in Bhagavad Gita we have that also. So there's now one other point I'll make here is that Krishna himself appears to be not sense controlled, isn't it? He's, despite being warned so many times, he's always stealing butter. And he's so greedy after butter that he breaks into houses. He's always surrounded by many women. No yogi should be surrounded by women. You're disqualified immediately. But that is a display of Krishna as being the master of the senses, that because he makes all, one of the features of him being the master of the senses is that he, through his potencies, his lila shakti, the potency who arranges all his pastimes, he makes all arrangements to fulfill his senses. So, as Srila Prabhupada said once, that Krishna is sometimes accused that he has 16,108 queens. He must be so lusty. So Srila Prabhupada said, well, why, for God, 16,108 is not a very big number. You could have so many more. It's not, for you, you think it's a lot, but for him, it's just a very small number, actually, a very select number of queens. And on the other hand, if you want to blame Krishna as being lusty, then you have to admit that he's the supreme lusty, because you cannot maintain 16,108 wives. So either way, Krishna is the master of the senses. No one can enjoy as much as Krishna can. You have to admit defeat before him. He is the master of the senses, not you. You can just be, you can either be envious, or you can assist him in his enjoyment. Actually, what can we do? I mean, one Satyabhama can please Krishna more than all of us put together. So, with our little attempts, what to speak of the devotees in Vrindavan? So, therefore, even more accurately defined, the symptom of a Vaishnava is that he considers himself Vaishnava Dasa Nudasa Nudasa Nudasa. He simply tries to assist those who are assisting those who are assisting those, and then you go up the other way, to those who are actually serving Krishna. But at the same time, we shouldn't think that then Krishna is just some kind of, you know, he's like us, we're just lusty in a mundane way, because Krishna's enjoyment is on a completely different platform. When we think Krishna's enjoying himself, but his enjoyment is actually giving pleasure to his devotees. So devotees, they're trying to please Krishna, and Krishna's trying to please the devotees, and there's no question of mundane lust in Krishna. As was seen when Indradev, seeing the austerities of Nara Narayana, sent beautiful girls to do the same thing as he did it with Vishvamitra, and he thought, well, okay, it's another yogi, okay, call up the Apsaras, send in the Apsara brigade and cause them to fall down. So, and along with Kamadev, the god of lust. So the whole posse of Apsaras were sent in to, and they, you know, they did their usual things, ring their ankle bell, dance a bit, and, you know, do the kind of Bollywood dances and all this kind of thing. And Nara Narayan looked and, nice dancing, that's good. So, you like Apsaras, Indra? Okay. And they just produced a whole bunch of more Apsaras, far more beautiful than the ones that Indra sent. He wasn't tempted. There's no question. Another thing is, they didn't become angry. Like Lord Shiva, he also didn't succumb to Parvati's inducements, but he also became angry, and then that's how Kamadev got the name Ananga, because Lord Shiva killed him, burned his body, and he didn't have any body left. So Vishnu, he's not disturbed by that which would disturb anyone else. He's not attracted to mundane sense enjoyment, but he is just like a conditioned soul in this material world is controlled by sensual desire. Krishna is controlled by the love of his devotees. It's the sensual exchange of Krishna and the devotees is very difficult to understand for mundane people, because what is going on in the name of pleasure in this world is the perverted reflection of the sense enjoyment in the spiritual world, where Krishna does like butter. It's a fact. He likes butter. He doesn't, he doesn't ask for meat or chocolate, or he likes butter. So devotees offer butter. So he does like it, but the rasa that comes from that, because he has likes and dislikes, and the devotees try to provide Krishna what he likes, and that, because they're trying to please Krishna, so that is what Krishna is controlled by the love of the devotees. So it's very, very difficult for mundane people to understand. Therefore, we don't discuss much about Krishna's intimate pastimes with the gopis or any such things, because it's so easy to misunderstand. But the basis of that is on Krishna's part also, even though in one sense he is the most selfish person possible. And that's true. If we say that, it's absolutely a fact. Krishna is so selfish. Everything is simply meant for him. But on the other hand, he is Atmarama. He takes pleasure only in himself. He doesn't need all these things. So another meaning of Atmarama is that he expands, all the living beings are all expansions of himself. So he takes pleasure in the pleasure of his devotees. So our senses are to be engaged in his service. That's the summary. Hare Krishna. That's all I'm going to say now, unless anyone has any questions about this. Looking at the... Is there a clock there, someone? I can't see it. See, our senses have limited ability. I can't see it because I'm not in the right position to do so. 9:40, late. Please.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I've also tried to make bhakti yoga, but I have the problem that if I want to look at the pleasure don't come immediately. There's some kind of like a void, and then there is the danger to go in material activities again.
Yeah.
Why is it like this, that the pleasure don't come immediately?
That's a very good question. That we're trying to perform bhakti. And for instance, we may look at the deity and we don't feel ourselves fainting on the spot in ecstasy. And therefore we may, because this is how it's difficult to make advancement in spiritual life, because the sensual pleasure we get is immediate and it's powerful. Anyway, but the thing is, it leaves us empty. It doesn't satisfy us. But it gives us an immediate charge of, I think they call it adrenaline. Well, that's the nature of an addiction, isn't it? That we keep, whatever it is, jabbing or shopping addiction or pornography addiction or gambling addiction, because it gives you an immediate rush of pleasure. But then afterwards you feel dissatisfied, and then you just try to get more and go back again and again, but it leaves you less and less satisfied. So one thing is, by the intelligence we understand that sensual pleasure doesn't give us any happiness. And the other thing is that the pleasure that comes from seeing the deity or chanting the holy name of Krishna, it's not exactly the same pleasure that we get from a mundanely enjoyed sense object. The pleasure comes, well, if we think that we're going to get the same kind of pleasure that we get from seeing the form of Radha Krishna, that we get from seeing the form of a beautiful woman, if we're in the same consciousness, then we don't get the pleasure, because the pleasure comes from giving ourselves to Krishna. And in that consciousness, Krishna gives himself to us. Then we're overwhelmed with the pleasure of Krishna consciousness. But as long as we're thinking that I will enjoy Krishna, it doesn't work. So it's required to undergo sadhana, in which we gradually train the senses to come out of that consciousness of let me enjoy. Even if we're thinking I will be happy in Krishna, let me hear the kirtan, oh, beautiful singer, great voice, beautiful music. Well, these are all elements, but if we're thinking I will enjoy, then we cannot actually experience the pleasure, which is definitely there in kirtan, but the real pleasure is there if we're thinking, let us sing nicely for the pleasure of Krishna, in the mood, praying to Krishna, please engage me in your service. And then the bliss comes. Dilemma, what's the word? Dichotomy. Paradox, that's it, yeah. As much as we're thinking, I shall be happy, it doesn't work. We don't get happiness. When we're not thinking of our own happiness, when we're only thinking of how Krishna will be happy, then by his grace we become so happy. So that training is required. It's not instant. It may not be instant. It requires some patience to rectify our old bad habit. Old means very old. So therefore we have to go on hearing the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, to understand, so that we can make intelligent decisions what to do. Otherwise, if we try to take to Krishna consciousness only on a sensual basis, that we will be happy by Krishna consciousness, it's not going to work, because that immediate sensual happiness we get, which isn't happiness, that always drags us down. So we should praise. Krishna is very beautiful. Kirtan is very enjoyable. But we should understand the underlying philosophy of how we're not the enjoyer of this material world. We are to be enjoyed by Krishna. Because if we simply talk about Krishna is beautiful, but we don't understand what is the nature of that beauty as compared to the beauty of this world, then we'll take the beauty of Krishna to be something like the beauty of this world. But as we are habituated to enjoy the beauty of this world, which actually isn't beautiful and entangles us in this world, and we're not retrained, or we haven't awakened our consciousness to actually experience the beauty of Krishna, then therefore we'll find that we don't actually get Krishna consciousness. Just by talking about the highest levels, we can't get there immediately. We have to go through the steps of cultivating Krishna consciousness, and on the positive side, and withdrawing ourselves from that which entangles us in this world. Until we're trained to distinguish by the intelligence the difference between the material and the spiritual. And until we actually develop our spiritual sense activity, because our experience is only on the mundane platform, then in the beginning we can't actually, we don't know what it is to experience on the spiritual sensual platform. So we have to go step by step. It's something of an analogy is that, well, in any discipline, we have to go step by step. We can't, someone was to come here and talk about, do we have any atomic physicists here, by the way? No. So if an atomic physicist was to come here and talk in all technical terms about atomic physics, he could go on for days and days, and we could sit for days. We wouldn't have a clue what he was. We'd never understand. We have to start at the beginning, which is, you know, kids go to school and they take, I don't know what they do nowadays, but they used to get one little wooden brick, another little brick, and 1 + 1 = 2. And that's the first training for the atomic physicist. And then later on, you know, you go step by step and it goes through mathematics and I don't know because I'm not an atomic physicist, but someone who is knows, and then they can understand. You have a whole bunch of atomic physicists talking in all these things we don't understand. I don't really know if they understand either, but they seem to. They get there step by step. So it's similarly with spiritual life. We start, yes, we say immediately, come see the beauty of Krishna. But for us to actually appreciate on the level of the residents of Vrindavan, we're going to have to be as fully surrendered to Krishna as they are, without any other desires, and that requires some training. Therefore, we have activities of sadhana, activities of service, just like go out in the streets and chant the holy names of Krishna. It takes a lot of surrender to do that, but that's very pleasing to Krishna, so Krishna blesses us. To distribute the books of Srila Prabhupada, to cook for the offering to Krishna. So all these activities, they purify our senses. So and Krishna gradually reciprocates more and more so that we can appreciate him. Requires some patience and some faith. Dedication, intelligence. It's not cheap. The beauty of Krishna is all attractive. But to come to the appreciation of that requires great, some endeavor on our regard. And a lot of mercy also coming down and a lot of effort on our part. Anything else? All right, so we'll finish there. What does it say now?
10 to 10.
Yeah. See, it doesn't get dark. When it gets dark, you know it should be the end of the day. But, funny, seems strange coming from a land where the sun sets more or less at the same time every day. And then you know, well, okay. It's all, now we have to, I guess clocks are more important in Switzerland. That's why they have all these. Famous clocks. William Tell, something else, famous for Switzerland, right? William Tell and the crossbow. Calvinism. Infamy. Okay, Hare Krishna. Saint Gallen, famous in Switzerland. I don't, never heard of him. It's from Ireland.
Christianity came from Ireland to Switzerland.
Did it really? I don't know. I never heard of it before until an hour ago or so. You're not from St. Gallen either. it seems. You never heard of the place. The name of the town that we are just presently in is called St. Gallen. You know that? Okay. All right. It's named after a saint from Ireland. Christianity came from Switzerland to Ireland. Switzerland to Ireland. Ireland to Switzerland. One of Ireland's old exports. Now Krishna Bhakti came. Okay, let's finish. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Maharaj, I'd like to thank you very much. It was very inspiring, very nice. I had actually one question, but I don't need to put it because somebody said you were famous for your heavy preaching or something like that, but I didn't see anything of that. It was very nice.
You didn't want to inspire it in me by asking a question?
No, it was very sweet.
Well, one reason I took up this Vishnu Sahasranama is because, practically all the topics that, the way Srila Prabhupada interacted in his preaching, he was taking on the world and showing people how they're foolishly wasting their lives and they should take to Krishna consciousness. So I generally try to do that also. And nowadays if you just speak as we always used to speak, that's considered very heavy and nasty and all that kind of thing. But maybe not by you, but how did I get that reputation? So, speaking about Krishna by Vishnu Sahasranam, philosophically understanding what is the nature of Krishna. So, yeah, it is important to understand who is Krishna. Right, at the end of all of that. I mean, our real aim of life is not just to point out that people are hogs, dogs, camels and asses in human form, but who we are supposed to be focusing on. Both things are required. Even before the 1 + 1 = 2, you have to get the kid to school. You may have to drag them. So that's the hogs, dogs, camels and asses stuff. Beating and dragging people to hear what they should hear.